is Side B of session number 55, recorded on February 18th, 2008. Now, Scott, you got something to continue with?
Yeah, so I was just noticing, you know, I mean, when we were doing the first four levels, Washington, Jefferson, Lincoln, and Roosevelt, each one was, you know, communicating through its own medium, a book or oratory or radio, and Kennedy, Nixon, Reagan, Perot, and Bob are all, well, they're, you know, television the television body or the television landscape is very prominent in each. And I noticed, but I think, would you agree that Kennedy and Reagan are both cool images for the TV, and Nixon and Perot are both hot images for the TV?
Yes, but Reagan provided hot verbal commentary. He renewed the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
In TV, you generally have to be cool. So that's a rule when you're operating through television. But Reagan did, that's when television is hidden ground. When it becomes conscious, and the public is conscious, and it's actually a retrieval, Reagan's retrieving the television image, or television is using the Reagan image to retrieve itself, it's a different situation. So that in the 80s, television actually in the content became hot. It was actually more violent. Crossfire came in, more soundbite debates, more so-called polarization between the liberals and conservatives. All of this was a different kind of television. So in the 80s,
the image was probably more high definition than it was in Kennedy. Kennedy was probably still a lot of black and white TVs. And
yeah, that's a good factor. The fact that television was moving towards a perfection of high definition visuals, that meant that a hotter content could be retrieved.
Mm-hmm. You know, this is on the side, but you know, we're talking about global warming. I know you. It was very interesting what you said. Probably too off topic to go into it right now about the seasons speeding up as the mixed corporate media speeds up through its cycles. So,
right.
But when we move into we're bringing high definition TV into the United States. It's going to probably be in every home in the next 5 years. I wonder how that's going to heat up things.
I don't think it is. I don't think television is that important now as a molding part of the, massaging part of the ground.
Oh, okay.
Because that's, I don't know, you can think of that as one-way broadcasting.
Yeah.
Two-way broadcasting, interactive is the rule.
The TV used to be a cool medium back when Marshall was first talking about it. It's going to be hotter than a movie theater when we get high def.
Right, because television in the 80s is not TV as a ground. It's just a figure in the mixed interplay.
Mm-hmm.
And it's has to become, it's almost a version of holopathic cliche probes. It becomes its opposite characteristic.
Mm-hmm.
Just like Dennis Hopper and the fragmented new decentralizing cliche probes in the other media were doing the wrong method.
Mm-hmm.
And Zappa, his image was that he didn't pander to the audience.
Mm.
The rule up to that point in entertainment was to pander to the audience. Dennis Hopper didn't pander to the audience.
Right.
The way he made Easy Rider. So television didn't pander to the audience and remained cool.
Mm-hmm.
It went hot. Not
yeah.
just by a high definition factor. It was the fact its content retrieved the Cold War. Now, the Cold War was a cool war for old hot cultures, hot industrial cultures. The ones that participated in World War One and Two, so they become figure again in the Reagan era, the hot part of the Cold War.
You know, I just noticed there's an interesting little metaphor in there. They refer to the new, you know, high-resolution TV as high def. It's like we're heightening the eye, and so it's going to deafen the ear or something. High def.
Yeah, but doesn't it make it more powerful sound too?
Yeah, you got the surround sound. Yeah, so I'd
say that the high definition is tactility going hot.
Mm.
This is all the senses improved,
yeah.
or going into high definition. So it's, even though tactility is not a particular condition or element or sense, it's the interplay, but the interplay has become hot. That's an interesting statement.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, with Kennedy, is he's getting all the wattage from TV as a hidden ground, a hidden environment, and it's live. And then with Reagan, TV is...
is nostalgia.
Nostalgia. Now, how does the TV watcher, the audience, relate to that? I mean, what is the difference in the viewer is watching Kennedy, and then 20 years later he's watching Reagan? How does he perceive his TV as being different?
Okay, so you're in the ground of the holopathic cliche probes in this Reagan era. Part of the characteristics of the holopathic cliche probe is it tends toward the interactive. It becomes smaller and more human scale, and the demographics are easier to respond to because it's not a mass one-way medium dealing with millions of people. You create small audiences, and you can make a livelihood out of that. The interactive nature is beginning to happen in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So... and that's part of the holopathy becoming smaller, so it's not as intimidating to the...
Well, 1980, audience. I don't know that the TV set's gotten smaller. It may have even gotten larger.
Well, the TV set gradually gets... it keeps getting larger and larger as it becomes hot, becomes like a movie, a hot medium.
Mm-hmm.
But the holopathy cliche pro, because it's getting smaller, it allows you to not feel intimidated, so you can participate a little more directly. Whereas before, you just participated in the image, in one-way media.
Yeah.
So the interactive nature of the holopathic ground makes people nostalgic for one-way broadcasting and make that one-way broadcasting become bigger and bigger as it gets weaker and weaker. McLuhan used to say, as the crowd gets bigger, it feels like it's getting smaller. So as television is actually confronting a shrinking situation, it needs to get bigger.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to feel bigger, so the screen gets bigger and bigger and goes toward the movie screen, the high definition,
mm-hmm.
a hot medium. So
television is so participatory today that if you're not on Survivor Island or in singing for the stars or whatever those shows are, if you're not in some... reality TV show, you're not participating in culture.
Yeah, you're not helping the interactive dialogue because the audience for those participatory shows are often stars. Stars are on the panels, right?
Oh, sometimes, but most of these shows. Well, like what's the show where you get on and sing and try to become the next hero?
American Idol,
yeah, no, those aren't celebrities, and the people on the Big Brother house are not celebrities, and the people on the Survival Island are not, the reality shows, those aren't celebrities. Sometimes they'll do a special celebrity one, but basically they're just...
No, listen to this. You remember over the past couple of years, they would bring a celebrity in, like Diana Ross of the Supremes, to educate the, test them out in their rehearsals.
Oh, yeah.
They would allow the ancient big one-way medium to come in as an honorary guest.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was more interactive. I mean, it had to establish itself as ignoring the star platform, the old one-way media, ignoring the global hologram. But once it established itself over by 2005, 2006, it could loosen up and allow the past back in.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So they would have these stars come in to sort of... not approval at their techniques or discipline them in the old standard way.
Right. Well, that's the whole thing with American Idol. You got the three celebrities that are going to evaluate and critique you to see whether or not you have celebrity, what it takes to become a celebrity.
Yeah, a celebrity is someone that's known for being well-known so that if you become a panelist, you eventually become a celebrity because you're the only constant factor.
Mm-hmm.
For the... compared to the competitors, even the winners disappear.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to move towards. Oh, I forgot to say. So you have.
Well, let me point out one thing about the Reagan level.
Let me say that. Yeah, with the Reagan level, I want to say this: lockdown universal government means going beyond the immediate solar system and going out there into the world of black holes, wormholes, and nebulae, constellations, huge galaxies. That retrieves the ET. So the ET fad starts in the Reagan era, on a huge level.
Star Wars.
Yeah, well, that's 77, and this is, the quadrant says, 60 to 77. And
I mean the real Star Wars, not the Lucas, but Reagan wants to implement Star Wars.
Right, which would be the solar government as a ghetto. The solar government, many people would say the Star Wars was impossible. Zappa got on The Tonight Show and those kind of mainstream talk shows at that time and said bacteriological biochemical warfare is more dangerous than missiles coming in.
Mm-hmm.
So he said Star Wars was misguided. But you could see that the military-industrial complex, like TV, was panicking, and they wanted to renew their budget. So they took the old environment from the previous phase, 45 to 60, the solar government, and made that an issue. While the population was ambivalent about that because they were involved with universal government images.
Mm-hmm.
Universal government being ETs and channeling and mediumship. If Ramtha, a warrior, an Atlantean warrior supposedly from 35,000 BC, comes back through J.V. Knight, and that actually gets talked about on mainstream TV by the middle 80s. There are specials done on her.
But there's special interest shows that I wouldn't say that it was a. I would say the average person on the street would not recognize Ramtha from a hole in the ground.
Well, if they watch Phil Donahue or those kind of.
I would
shows,
say he's not really that big. It's not really a pop cultural phenomena or a fad on that level. It's just a special interest story that some people are going to pick up on.
The homeopathic cliche probe. It's a niche market. But a niche market can get more and more on the old one-way media. So the Phil Donahue, I remember seeing her being presented on a major show.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a passing quirk, but the need for TV to attract attention and go towards appropriating the margins more and more led to her getting that kind of big approval. And then, you know, later they have psychics as regular TV shows by the late 90s.
Yeah.
But the, so I call that the universal. It's not just, it's sort of bringing in the astral levels.
Yep.
So things are getting pretty blurry by the time of the holopathic cliche probes. So that if the environment is getting tinier and tinier and getting more and more invisible, then invisible dimensions or old rearview mirror images of invisibility are allowed to appear as figures. So that's UFOs, ETs, and channeled spirits.
Yeah.
They represent the invisible.
But I'd say it's only been within the last couple of years that those things are becoming, that there's enough coverage of, like on the Discovery Channel and Larry King are covering the UFO channeling psychic phenomena.
Because they had to.
To the point where it's actually part of everyday TV.
Yeah, those shows cover every niche market, every little cliche probe stage.
Yeah.
Everything gets on Larry King. All these little demographics.
Mm-hmm.
They all have a chance on there. And they come and they go. But remember, in the middle 90s, it's way past the Reagan era, but you have the rise of Art Bell and Coast to Coast.
Est was a big phenomenon in 77.
What was?
Est, Werner Erhard, that would have been late 70s, I guess, yeah.
Yeah, that was a McDonaldization of the TV effect.
Yeah, of the Buddhist migration.
Right. What McLuhan called, he called Estland the Lourdes. You know, Lourdes in France, where they're supposed to be
right.
Like a Catholic shrine, place where there were miracles. So he said that Esalen was the Lourdes of the multi-sensuous exploration movement,
mm-hmm.
which was what TV brought in. So now you have the ghettoization of it and commercialization of it through Werner Erhard and Est. which provide a tiny, quickie version of a long Alan Watt seminar.
Yeah, but also everybody heard of EST. I mean, my mom and dad, no matter who you talked to, everybody knew what EST was. Not everybody knew what Esalen or Little East. You know, once right. EST opened the door, for people who went into EST, it opened the door for Esalen and Rompha and all these other things.
Yeah.
But whether you went to EST or not, everybody knew about EST.
And EST was a big deal by the early 80s. It had become the forum and other things, but a lot of people were taking it. And that's during this universal government period.
Yeah.
But it was rapidly obsolesced by and got absorbed by corporations. They had to absorb these consultants.
Mm-hmm.
I know a few of them that went on to do that in the 80s and did well. Because the old corporate hardware world started needing, as they broke apart, they needed new conceptual input, injections, nutrition, for keeping corporate unity in their staff. So EST went into the corporations while the more extreme versions took over in the popular psyche.
Mm-hmm. I think it's worth mentioning on this level, 1980 level, that in you got the computer and the atom bomb. Reagan obsolesces the atom bomb when the Soviet Union breaks up.
Yeah, no, that's a good point, and he does it with the computer. It's the computer that collapsed, the computer effects that collapsed the Soviet Union. So.
Because their economy couldn't cope with the computer effects?
Couldn't keep up with the speed of innovation and adaption, adaptation.
Oh, yeah.
And adoption. I mean, it just collapsed.
Yeah.
The world was, okay, this is, you know, that's 1989. You're looking at 1918 to 45 is the computer and the atom bomb. So 40 years later, the older institutions, built on the newspaper and old hardware, they can't stand up to the computer speed by the late 80s.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what's interesting is Reagan is being a tactile president. He's actually working both sides, television and computer.
Yeah. Well, the Soviet Union, because of the bureaucracy and the fact that they didn't allow for the entrepreneurship of the individual. I think that they turned into a bureaucracy that just couldn't cope, couldn't change fast enough.
Yeah.
But in America, you know, this was also true in World War. This is kind of interesting. I heard in World War II, I'm not 100%. I'm no historian here, but something to the effect that we were outnumbered airplane for airplane by the Japanese, and the Japanese had been trained over a longer period of time under a much stricter regimen, and that to be able to fly under command, to be able to maneuver they had better airplanes, and they were able to maneuver them more tightly and in formations, they had much more training. A lot of the American pilots, we were building these airplanes as fast as we could and throwing guys in there who'd hardly flown at all and just saying, turning them loose against a well-trained air force that the Japanese had. But the Americans took the Japanese down because the Americans knew how to think on their own as individuals and make their own decisions. The Japanese were trained to follow commands. So they're waiting for their commands, and they're following their commands, but they don't know how to break up into individual units and do tricky stuff that only an individual could think up in the spur of the moment. They were trained to operate like a machine, and the Americans could become entrepreneurs in the sky and figure out stuff that nobody'd ever thought of before on the spur of the moment. And that's probably why America could adapt to the computer change when the Soviet Union couldn't.
Yeah, the decentralization in the long run is toward individual autonomy. And McLuhan writes about this in Take Today. The West had the camaraderie, the inspiration of individuals working in the way you're talking about, that had an advantage over the robotic behavior of the oral-based societies that felt superior because of radio.
Mm-hmm.
But there was an ongoing trend of media, so the American culture, the American sensibility was avant-garde. It maintained the services of the individualist alphabetic effect, and that helped in the decentralization that both America and Japan were undergoing. You're saying they could function with a sense of initiative more and innovation than the
right.
strictly robotic oral cultures.
Yeah.
Now, so your point about that is?
Well, I think that that's probably why the Soviet Union collapsed, because they didn't promote the sense of individual freedom and entrepreneurship. So some guy comes up with a really good idea, but he can't implement it because he's inside this huge bureaucracy that's moving like a snail. And in America, everybody's like, hey, turn the chickens loose and let them run around and figure out what to do for themselves. And so, you know, you have a bunch of individuals who are being creative as opposed to a mass of individuals who are all, you know, following in lockstep with one another.
Okay, so as the global hologram shrinks and the human being feels bigger than the shrinking hologram, it tends toward individual autonomy, and certainly the digital technology pushes that towards that level, so that you have an individual like Dennis Hopper or Zappa beginning that trend of doing their own thing and ignoring the one-way medium mandates and protocols. And so that expands even more and more as you get into the 80s. You have more and more singular individuals creating new fads, new cliche probes.
Mm-hmm.
So that leads to the next level. The anthropomorphic...
No, new cliche probes. Okay, we talked about holopathic cliche probes, and we kind of got an idea of what that is. But why is it a cliche probe? We've talked about how we've taken the global theater and made it smaller and then fragmented it into multiple smaller global theaters called holopathic cliche probes. Well, why is it a cliche probe?
Because it's older media being recycled. Now, we did this in the McLuhan section. Remember the relationship between cliche and archetype?
Yeah.
And archetype was the rearview mirror visual space, and cliche was the new tactile probe.
Mm-hmm.
Multi-sensuous probe, not limited to literary reference points. So the cliche probe in a tribal society has depth. This is what McLuhan says: the visual culture society is simple, lives on the surface. But when you have an oral society, it goes into depth and then repeats patterns, but they have new aspects to them. So that is the nature of the preliterate cultures. So now in the post-literate, you have this depth awareness and the use of individuals putting new nuances on the old media environments. All right. Now, if you're Dennis Hopper and you make movies, or you're Zappa and make albums, and anybody else that was like that, they were confronting the fact that no matter what they did, they'd still be a nobody. As McLuhan wrote in his New York Times op-ed in 1974, everybody into nobody, because everything is shrinking. There's less of an audience, so they're going to have an identity crisis.
Because the audience is looking for its own audience. Everybody's putting on their own sideshow, and everybody's looking for their own audience.
That's right. They want to hijack whatever the latest cliche probe is and to make it their own so that they can have an audience. So that you read about these directors like Hopper and Coppola. What's the name of that book? Easy Riders and the boxing one, Bull.
Raging Bull?
Raging Bulls. This guy does a history of them in the early 90s, and they were just totally chaotic and a massive identity crisis and drug use and chaos in their lives. They actually were having a tough time.
You mean the actors and the movie makers?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh.
That book documents the chaos in their lives.
Oh.
I mean, what's his name?
In other words, they said that the movies almost didn't get made because everybody was stoned.
Yeah, and a lot of adjustment in what they were doing to the larger ground, which was changing under them.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the cliche aspect of their probe, in cliche in the sense of old-fashioned, would sneak up on them pretty quickly.
Hmm. In other words, they were becoming they were becoming outdated before they could finish their project.
Right, because
they were becoming nostalgia before they could finish the project.
Yeah, because they were part of a larger anti-environment, which was the rapid series of innovations. So that in the 70s, you needed Rumpelstiltskins, we'll call them, in music, in radio, in newspapers, in television. But the whole effect was all of them together.
Mm-hmm.
And that was an anti-environment to the shrinking of the audience.
Mm-hmm.
So remember, it's a rapid series, whole bunch of innovations as ersatz anti-environment. So Hopper and Zappa or any of these people were filling in one segment of the elephant,
mm-hmm.
right? And the elephant itself was a temporary anti-environment.
Mm-hmm.
So that is causing the identity crisis. So people are taking cocaine so they can speed up and keep up with the ground around them that they're trying to make a comment on.
Right.
Or relate to.
Yeah.
So cliche probe.
Because the artist is trying to, he's got his ear to the ground, he's trying to hear what's going on right now, and then he's trying to communicate it. But
right.
If by the time he gets around to figuring out how to communicate it, the ground's already changing, he's got to figure out another way to say it.
Yeah, he's got to find a new audience, because the audience he thought he was targeting has moved on to other issues and other concerns.
But you can always find an audience.
Oh, yeah, and more. Look at YouTube. Anybody
yeah.
can find an audience today.
Right.
But it's a temporary audience, and it's very hard to make any money from it.
Yeah.
So that we're talking about the...
You know, when we're talking about cliche and archetype, it just occurred to me that the ALP stage, it's not cliche yet, and it certainly is an archetype because it hasn't moved through the stages of cliche. So where does the ALP stage fit in Marshall's cliche to archetype model?
Well, that's where we're getting into the merger. Remember how Reagan is both television and computer and atom bomb?
Uh-huh.
Nixon is airplane and television, but weak on the television.
Mm-hmm.
That leads to Watergate. But Reagan is stronger in television, a little weak in the computer and atom bomb, because he's gearing up for a renewed Cold War and doesn't know the technology that he's going to use is going to create a disappearance of his audience. Who's his audience? The Soviet Union. The other disappears.
Mm-hmm. Well,
the very environment that he's using.
Yeah.
So
I don't know.
He doesn't have a purpose in the second administration.
Well, his audience was the American public. I don't know if I would call his audience the Soviet Union.
No. Think of media dynamics. The dynamics within the global theater are the different national icons and the media biases they represent. Remember
yeah.
that.
We're
yeah. not looking at an individual. We're talking about Reagan's image.
Right.
Reagan's image thought that the Soviet Union was going to become a big threat by the middle 80s. It started to weaken as Gorbachev comes in 85, and by 86, 87, a sign of a weakened image is it starts being subjected to a scandal, and the Iran-Contra thing starts in late 86.
Right.
So he's weakened for a second, last few years of his second term. He's
yeah.
a weakened image.
Right. I'm just not sure I would refer to that as being his audience. I see the dynamic there, but I'm not sure it's...
No, his audience is when you're multi... sensuous tactility and multimedia, you got many audiences.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, the American audience is one of his audiences.
Mm.
I mean, television has many audiences. So,
I mean, in a way, the Soviet Union is content for Reagan's presidency.
For the atom bomb.
For the atom bomb, yeah.
But the computer part is going to undermine that.
Yeah, because it's... right.
Okay, so then... Now, that's 60 to 77.
So did you answer my question? Does ALP fit into Marshall's cliché to archetype model?
Okay, I was just looking at this, and it seems in the long run, the Shem column starts out as outsider enemy, but usually wins in the long run.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Because the Sean medium is moving towards the past, the anthropomorphic, sociological, psychological lag.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So you will see that the computer and atom bomb is going to beat television. Before that, television beat the airplane. Nixon got Watergated. Now you're getting the anthropomorphic physical, which just means the human body or consciousness is now bigger than the media, because the media has gone through the holy pathic cliche probe phase and shrunk. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, cliche probe is meant to have a double entendre. You're replaying old media, and since nobody can handle the total erasure that the absence of the global theater and the absence of the audience create under holopathic media, then you're going to have any retrieval of anything as a probe, as a sense, oh, we're still here. So that the 80s, late 70s, early 80s, called the rerun decade.
Mm-hmm.
Rerun.
Yeah.
Didn't Gil Scott Heron, in his song The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, which came out about 81, 82, he talks about Ronald Reagan as rerun? I think that's one of his lines in there.
Yeah, I don't remember.
But the rerun, each rerun is a temporary old medium probing and offering itself as a temporary antidote to the disappearance of everything,
mm-hmm.
all right? And it's often cliché. So, but it is cliché, but the cliché appears new. There's nothing old under the sun anymore, was how McLuhan changed that old aphorism, there's nothing new under the sun.
Mm-hmm.
Now there's nothing old. And that's the junk culture, what McLuhan called the garbage apocalypse. More and more things are engaging the audience's attention.
Mm-hmm.
Or the global participant. More and more people are participating in cliche probes.
Mm-hmm.
All kinds of retrievals and clubs. And
although, but even by Perot, the anthropomorphic physical is probably not a cliche probe yet.
The anthropomorphic physical is happening from 1960 to 1990. That's what we're going to get to in the next chart.
Mm-hmm.
But it is ground from 77 to 92 within the context of this chart. And that is the human consciousness thinking it's bigger than media and is not going to put up with it anymore. They still quote Network, the 1976 movie, right? I'm
right.
bad as hell, I'm not going to put up anymore. That's what Perot represents.
Right.
But what he does is he retrieves the computer and atom bomb scenario to fight the satellite and laser beam, which is a tough environment to fight. That's a global hologram. How can you fight that from a nationalist podium
mm-hmm.
as a White House president?
Mm-hmm.
Can't fight it. So the computer and atom bomb will lose, the satellite laser beam will win, and then in the next phase, satellite laser beam lose to the holopathic cliche probes. Now, what does that flat line mean? The flat line means the merger of first nature and second nature. Technologies like cold fusion are
right.
now acquiring the characteristics of first nature. And so that's where we're leading to.
When does Pons and Fleischmann make their announcement?
Last week of March 1989.
Okay.
And within 2 years, many labs, I think it's about 600 labs, have proven that it seems to work.
And since by this time, HCE, which used to consist of all of the intelligence agencies around the world, now consists of Bob. Bob, being a good HCE, is aware of the cold fusion happening in the ALP stage.
Right. So in the previous phase, when I have locked down mythic government, I define myth in my memo to Prince Charles as a mixture of any media. That's your mixed corporate media.
Mm.
That I was using in the late 80s. A mixture of any media becomes your religion or your pattern or your obsession or your
hologram or a matrix that you a hologram or a matrix that you clothe yourself with.
Right, and it's post satellite global hologram. It is involved with the holopathic cliche probes, and even past that, where tiny little media, because they've shrunk.
Well, that's why the anthropomorphic physical is beginning to come in the ALP stage, because once the anthropomorphic physical can start clothing itself with cliche probes,
in other words, think of pop culture.
Instead of being inside the environmental landscape, it's putting on the environment as jewelry.
What'd you say? As a what?
Jewelry.
Jewelry, as what they call accessory culture.
Yeah.
So it's like Zappa making that quilt out of audience underwear and bras. Remember?
I didn't know he did that. I remember he used to get the women to throw their pianos up on the stage, but I didn't know he did anything with them.
Yeah, he gathered them together and sent them to this woman artist in Colorado or someplace, and she stitched them all together, and eventually, I don't know when, in the early 90s or some point, presented the quilt as a gallery piece.
That's cool.
With all the underwear and, I guess, with their stains. I don't know if she washed them.
Oh, my God.
So there's the quilt. The mosaic mesh of television now has happened individually for people so that the global hologram had a tactile interplay between huge media environments. As they get shrunk, you end up with the kind of Madonna image where her fashion style, at least in the middle 80s, was a patchwork of underwear worn outside and different accessories from different fashionable eras.
Mm-hmm.
So that in the rock and roll disco culture was symbolized by her, this mythic stage where you patch together your favorite artifacts.
Mm-hmm. From different timelines.
Different what?
Timelines.
That's right, yeah. And you can do that. And that is the beginning of the human.
That's the beginning of time travel.
The beginning of each human being a tetrad manager.
Mm.
Just as in the 50s, 60s, a tetrad manager offers a mosaic interplay of media called the global theater, now you can do it with
mm-hmm.
your Walkman and VHSs and tape. Another part of that was the tape cassette culture. People would make their favorite music. And
yeah, I used to do that. I haven't done that for years, but I'd get a big album collection, and then I would take my favorite songs from each album and splice them onto a single cassette tape, and then I'd have a cassette tape made of, you know, Scott's top hits, top 40.
So that would be your own little art form, your own little presentation of your identity.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Perot, in this period, Perot is putting on the national myth with an AP aspect of we need to put this house in order. It's small enough to put in order. And he tried to patchwork education over his infomercials and seeking different audiences based on different grievances so that the rage of having been ripped off by one-way media now surfaces as a political agenda.
Mm-hmm.
A different image than Reagan, who's trying to retrieve national unity, national honor, and overcoming the stain of Vietnam. Now, Perot represents a guy who says, this country is beyond redemption unless we really do something radical. He's ignoring the unity that Reagan created, supposedly.
Yeah.
And the unity Reagan represented, was just the one-way unity of tactile television. So
where you have the computers and atom bombs in the Perot level,
yeah,
beating out the, how does that work there? You have them in the Reagan level under Shem, and then they, what, beat out the television and become Sean and Perot. I would say the computer beats out the television, but the atom bomb should drop out because the Cold War is over at that point.
But did you notice that it didn't? We actually had the rise of terrorism, which is the AP.
But that doesn't happen until Bush the second.
No, it's starting. The Clinton administration is concerned about terrorism. I mean, you had the bombing of the World Trade Center in February 1993. 1 year after the Perot date, 1992.
Mm, yeah.
I mean, it's not becoming a huge environment. By the time it gets to the Bush world, it is obsolete. That's why it becomes a big issue, right?
Well, I guess if you want to make the atom bomb symbolic for terrorism, terrorists don't use atom bombs or haven't so far.
Yeah, but the myth is, because of the decentralization and shrinking of media, anybody can be a Zappa or a Dennis Hopper. Or a hijacker of media environments.
Right.
Anybody can get a dirty bomb now.
Yeah.
So,
I remember they used to complain.
Now, I want to mention this, the interplay between television and computer and atom bomb and Reagan phase. You notice, as we move along the chart, the interplay means that each Shem and Shan can interplay, so that the president is using both, because there is the larger implosion going on. Super, super dark energy implosion, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where it's becoming one after image of the word that makes the market, which is the White House. So that the Rumpelstiltskin, which is my term for an anthropomorphic physical hijacker, like Zappa was. Zappa even said his own house was in Rumpelstiltskin decor. All right, the hijacking of all mass of previous media environments becomes more and more the nature of politics. And that's what Perot does. He hijacks as a Rumpelstiltskin, playing off a patchwork of satellite and laser beam and computer and atom bomb. I can't remember his positions on Star Wars or on the use of the atom bomb, but he certainly was projected as a paranoid.
Yeah, I remember he wanted to. He thought there were prisoners of war in Vietnam that had never been retrieved, and he wanted
right.
to go in with.
Now there's a fringe issue to make up.
Vogue rights and get them.
Right, but that's a fringe issue, becoming part of his patchwork quilt.
Mm-hmm.
His pattern recognition myth. I mean, he's picking from the decentralized and the centralized.
Remember Bo Greitz and his...
Definitely.
There was... KPFK was playing him a lot, and his... He represented a kind of this super-conservative patriot, paranoid, let's bunker...
And he's the world order.
Yeah.
The world order. In other words, you had that Craig guy that Roy would play a lot, who got fed up after Clinton got in because none of the lefty programmers would invite him back to critique Clinton. So he got fed up at because he wanted to critique both of them because he was representing a paranoid AP in relation to the media is shrinking so that an individual is bigger than the world government. So you start lashing out at it, beating it up. And there's different definitions of what the world government is. And this is all crystallized by X-Files. Starts in 93, I think.
Oh, yeah.
So X-Files is showing the enemy is a global Bilderberger kind of elite who are in touch with ETs. That's the previous phase of universal government. And people oscillated between... that's when Ultimate Top Secret came out, that book about MJ-12. In other words, the mixture of paranoid scenarios about who was controlling the planet went from world government to solar government to universal government to mythic government. So people would...
When did the MK Ultra books get published?
Well, Walters got published in 78. But that's chemical body MK Ultra.
Mm.
What you get by the early 90s is scenarios like HARP.
Yeah.
The idea that someone is taking an invisible spectrum of advanced technology in the dark energy world, and it's massaging you. That's like, that HARP is like a homeopathic AARP, you know. You could probably project, see, homeopathic is an invisible massager. That makes the HARP concept. Or people in the early 90s used to think beams came out of the CN Tower in Toronto and was mind-controlling populations way beyond what Walter wrote in 78, but Walter got into the later scenarios in the 90s in his updated Operation Mind Control.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got this anthropomorphic situation, which is going to lead into the tiny note chart. But I just want to say that the Lockdown Bob Rule represents an ultimate Rumpelstiltskin.
What he is... Got to keep defining Rumpelstiltskin for me, because I never, it's a slippery term, and I never quite know what you mean by how, why you chose that term to represent that, whatever the idea is.
Do you remember the fairy tale?
Yeah, let's see, the guy, wasn't the guy who fell asleep for 20 years, was it?
No, that's Rip Van Winkle.
That's Rip Van Winkle. So Rumpelstiltskin is my name. Oh, yeah, he captures the princess, and she's got to guess his name, or something bad's going to happen?
Yeah, he hijacks the princess, steals her, and creates fear all over the town. He's a Bin Laden, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And you can't control him or beat him until you find out what his name is. When you can name him, then you have collapse of Rumpelstiltskin.
Mm-hmm.
So he celebrates his name. He's dancing around his little campfire or whatever, gloating over his victory over the town, and he's celebrating the fact that no one will know his name, and he gives the name, and someone overhears it. Can't remember who overhears it. And spreads the name, and then his power is gone. So McLuhan's theme that once you name an environment, you can control it. The effort is to name the hijackers of the homeopathic cliche probe solar universal mythic theater.
And thus strip them of their power?
Right. If you name what they're made up of, like if you name exactly what Zappa is doing or Dennis Hopper or any of the later Rumpelstiltskins that came out of rap culture, if you name the figures and causes and effects, which my chart claims to be doing, I'm naming the makeup of Rumpelstiltskin and how it came to the point where we've been hijacked in the age of terror.
Oh.
You know, by one entity, a guy in a cave, talking about a Paleolithic retrieval.
Yeah.
This myth or pattern or fact, it's ambivalent. You can't name exactly what Bin Laden is.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact, McLuhan wrote an essay in the mid-50s for Explorations, his Explorations magazine, where he said, we don't know whether it's, and I cite the four phases, four aspects in Up the Orphanity, but he says, we don't know if it's national myth-making, collective phobia, individual sensation, or cultural something. Let me just think. National myth-making, collective phobia, cultural norm-making, or individual sensation. We don't know what is the reason that Rumpelstiltskin can be successful. So he doesn't say exactly which one Rumpelstiltskin is. He says it seems to be an interplay of those four factors. National myth-making. I remember Perot, his image was like a little Rumpelstiltskin. Okay, if you think of him, hijacking the electoral process of 1992. But you have him playing up national myth-making, collective phobia, cultural norm, and individual sensation. It was all about his view of what we need to correct. So Rumpelstiltskin...
He gets named and loses the race?
His pattern, his myth, his quilt gets understood. Because events change, the ground changes.
Oh, interesting.
So, yeah, it's not verbal naming anymore.
You lose a lot of charisma once they understand your game, I guess, huh?
That's right. Like that happened to McCarthy in 54 when he went on TV, went on a different medium. His effect was diminished.
Because his game became obvious.
Yeah. His radio sensibility. So you'll see, I have the Rumpelstiltskin in the other chart, the tiny note chart, talking about 1960 to 1990, and we have increasing hijacking of the shrinking media environment happening. But it does begin in the LaRouche Quadrant with the McCarthy era.
Mm-hmm.
So the nature of Rumpelstiltskin changes through the different phases, and that's what I show on the tiny note chart, which we'll go into probably starting next week.
Right.
So you see, Perot is a Rumpelstiltskin, then I become a new kind of Rumpelstiltskin and hijack the whole process, supposedly. And I'm hijacking, my image is resonant with the 1990 to 2020 phase. And I represent, remember what I say I am, chairperson of the Secret Council 10. That is a committee formed by the satellite and laser beam environment, which was 45 to 1960, right? 1945 to 1960. I use my solar government manipulation to counter the homeopathic cliche probes or all the other Rumpelstiltskins. So I'm super Rumpelstiltskin against the trend of everybody becoming increasingly over the last 25 years.
But newer environments have the power to dissolve advantage of the satellite and laser beam or the solar government? I mean, doesn't the universal and then the mythic being newer and thus more charismatic have the power to dilute or dissolve the power of the...
What did I do in 1988, February?
That's right. You dismembered.
This out of the Secret Council 10. I dismantled the solar government.
Yeah.
And became a homeopathic cliche probe on my way to moving past that.
Well, now what are the what is the composite elements of the homeopathic cliche probe that you became?
Mr. Nelson Thal. He took my radio show and made an album in 92.
Mm-hmm.
Bosmeat Ecology.
Mm.
I had nothing to do with it. He marketed it. He retrieved me.
That's what makes you a homeopathic cliche probe?
That's, yes. He made me a homeopathic cliche probe. And I used that for
On the whole planet of 6 or 8 billion people, what do you think, maybe 100 people heard that record and five of them still have a copy of it?
Because to beat the other Rumpelstiltskin who still think there's an audience, even though it may be tiny, and they get their little audience, they eventually end up in the Dendy crisis because it has no staying power. Me knowing there's no audience and everything's disappeared gives me the advantage over those Rumpelstiltskins, and I know the nature of the new Rumpelstiltskin, which is to be a chaos butterfly, tiny, tiny, tiny effect over the homeopathic ripples.
And all of the previous media environments then begin to cluster around the Bob nodule, the Bob node.
There's the Android memes and Arcany. Why do these major media, major cliche probes, produced by all kinds of Rumpelstiltskins, the Wachowski brothers were Rumpelstiltskins. They hijacked the movie process with their old fringe movie, The Matrix. But they all reflect me. That's the interesting point.
Or you managed to put yourself at the center of their game. I mean, as far as they were concerned, they were adapting a novel from Philip K. Dick.
Yeah, with a little help from Baudrillard, or what they thought Baudrillard was about.
Right. And then we don't know if then you somehow figure how to fit yourself into the center of that, or whether you always were at the center of that.
I always was, because that movie comes out in 99, 9 years after Lockdown Bob Rule, which is 1990-2020. Actually, what happened in 1990 was Twin Peaks. That really crystallized the process.
Yeah, I remember that did have a lot of strange Bob elements.
Right. And it was not limited to the Church of the Subgenius Bob, J.R. Bob Dobb stuff. A lot of the things in my actual life and in Connie's life were in that movie.
No, there were elements in that movie that the Subgenius people had never even... couldn't even recognize when they saw it.
That's right. So we're talking about the media. Because I know the nature of the older forms of the Rumpelstiltskins, and I don't even have to, because I'm the ground, I don't even have to try to put myself in the movies. I never had any involvement with the Wachowski brothers or anybody else, SpongeBob or anything. But they pick up on what I'm doing in those particular years that they make the movie. Technically, they find out exactly. They pick it up through this very imploded, incredible ESP state going on, right? Incredible synchronicity.
Yeah.
And the strangeness of it, it keeps leading back to me, and then I see that. The only reason I'm still here and powerful is I didn't identify with it. I knew that the naming process had to be like dark energy, something very homeopathic, if at all.
Yeah.
So you have this movie... In 2006.
Well, what do you identify with?
You people.
No.
The new AP is what I identify with. And the new AP is a combination of the astral body, chip body, chemical body, and TV body, plus whatever mystery body elements are manifest.
Mm-hmm.
So I represent the present.
And
what is actually happening. And if you read those, you're starting to read the GLOW transcripts. It's very interesting that the entities known as McLuhan, Zappa, and Joyce, and a little Wyndham Lewis, actually complement my chart and what I'm doing. And they try to describe that the device offshore sounds like what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Not offshore, off-planet device. But you maybe not have read, I've just been posting them up. But
well, the off-planet device that he talks about initially, and I only read, you know, a little bit into the first and second sessions, sounds like the same paranoia we were talking about earlier with the beams, with HARP and beams coming out of the Transamerica building.
Right, but McLuhan is celebrating it. He's saying this is going to stop the other, more paranoid devices, the other two. You'll read that later when you get further.
Why? Because it's being controlled by spiritual beings who are benevolent and working.
McLuhan from the astral plane says he, even from their perspective, they can't figure out what it is.
Then so how do they know it's gonna work out okay? They don't know what they're dealing with.
That's right. That's why he was communicating. But there's a lot more to say about that. Maybe we'll get that in the next session. But the point is, he sees a positive effect. He's pulling for it, and he's describing what I call the mystery body. That's what's showing up, and it shows up after 2000, which is interesting.
Mm.
After the replay of the Android meme.
Maybe it's the second coming. Maybe it's our own consciousness being made manifest.
We're almost finished, right?
Yeah.
Near the end?
Yeah.
Well, I'll wrap up with this statement, but I just wanted to finish the previous statement, is that the tiny note chart is a picture of the after image of the Android meme of the 90s, because it's showing the ground, the Lockdown Bob Rule mystery body element, which is made up of the previous four bodies plus. Now, I have always maintained that I'm an expert on the Second Coming. You can look at a chart that Nelson and Bob Marshall made in April 22nd, 1985, or maybe it was the second one, July 22nd, 1985, or the third one, September 22nd, 1986, you'll see the bottom-up chart, and the last phase is the Second Coming as ground. Do you remember that on those perfect pitch charts?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I was talking about that to Nelson and other people back in 84, 85, and I've always been describing the Second Coming. And I consider two statements as a beginning way of looking at what I mean. You take the Evergreen statement, their definition of the Second Coming is a time of perpetual change. Think of rapid series of innovations as ersatz and environment. And then that's McLuhan's overlap there. And McLuhan, there was a great essay written by a critic of McLuhan called, this was in the 60s, Which Way Did the Second Coming Went? And so determining where we are and when the Second Coming happened is what I'm an expert on. And the chart is showing that. But the hint of that was in an earlier chart. So I'm an expert on the Second Coming, and I guess we'll get into that. I'm one of the few experts. As a matter of fact, I was just posting I was listening to an old Evergreens tape from a few years ago, and discussing with the Evergreens my monopoly in the world of understanding the Second Coming. So definitely that's an aspect here. So what we have is many myths, many media being retrieved. That's what mythic government means. Each person picks up and makes a mosaic quilt of their favorite myth and retrieve them, and they represent the Second Coming of those media.
Mm-hmm.
Fan clubs, chat lines, news groups are OCD with their mythic Second Comings.
Oh, what's an OCD?
Obsessive compulsive disorder.
Oh.
So
you should post that Evergreen tape where they're talking about you and the Second Coming someplace.
Yeah, I'd have to transcribe it. I'll get to that in due time. Evergreens is pretty pretty important stuff.
Yeah. Dub it and put it up, put up the audio.
Right. So just to show, I was saying about 2006 in October, out came the movie Man of the Year, about Tom Dobbs, who used the computer glitch like I did in 88 to get the White House, which the White House being a mixture of the four worlds.
That is pretty funny.
So that was a more recent Xenocrony.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have anything to do with the script, consciously.
No, I know.
So that's the one aspect of Lockdown Bob Rule is I'm perpetually naming the situation, and the name surfaces as some entertainment phenomenon. Like SpongeBob. That's an attempt to name what Rumpelstiltskin is.
Right.
I didn't name it, but my intuition about how to name it is a signpost, like a gold standard, in these major phenomena. And I don't speak that out of ego. It's just a retrospective fact.
Yeah.
Which I didn't create.
You're in the eye of the hurricane, Bob. You're the center of the cyclone.
Or the ear. I'm also decentered.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't just be a visual image.
Okay. You're like Merlin with his wand, chanting out the magic syllables and conjuring up all the elements to work together to do their magic.
And that's an image from the manuscript culture. Now you have to use and quote all the different homeopathic cliche probe replays. And that's what I do. It's right on the chart. I've got all the media referenced.
You're beyond satellite conductor.
Yeah. Okay, so I think that's it.
Okay. Signing off.